KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Fired after he suffered a stroke. He sued the hospital, saying he was discriminated against based on his disability and race. Religious groups, employment lawyers, and constitutional scholars are closely watching the case. The number of Washington hospitals with religious affiliations is on the rise. A street on Seattle's Capitol Hill in the central area could be known as McKinney Avenue to recognize the Reverend Dr. Samuel McKinney. He's pastor emeritus of one of Seattle's oldest black churches, Mount Zion Baptist. The church opens onto 19th Avenue. Two city council members are scheduled to talk at Mount Zion this afternoon about renaming the street Reverend Dr. Samuel B. McKinney Avenue between East Union and Republican Streets. McKinney has been active in civil rights in Seattle. He hosted Martin Luther King Jr.'s only appearance in Seattle in 1961. Mount Zion expanded under McKinney's tenure and established a school and low-income housing. Other honorary street names in Seattle recognize the playwright August Wilson, Mariners broadcaster Dave Niehaus, and Mariners designated hitter Edgar Martinez. And an inaugural festival celebrating the life and work of short story writer Raymond Carver opens today in Port Angeles. He died there in 1988. The Peninsula Daily News reports that Carver's widow, the poet Tess Gallagher, approached Peninsula College more than a year ago with the idea for the festival. The festival will include readings and lectures as well as movies based on his work. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Regional Heart Center.
52 degrees in Seattle, cloudy and foggy. Expecting sun this afternoon with a high of 73. Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at ZurichNA.com. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher's on sabbatical till October. We've had a summer-like stretch of weather lately, and that seems to have brought out all of Seattle into the great outdoors. But even when it's not nice outside, we love our parks and recreation centers here. The big problem has been how to support them financially. To that end, the City of Seattle has come up with something called the Parks Legacy Plan. City officials are vetting the plan in a series of public meetings this month. Actually, they're taking public comment about what the plan should be. And joining us to talk more about the whole project is Seattle City Council member Sally Bagshaw. She chairs the City Council committee that oversees the Parks and Recreation Department. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Marcy.
Before we talk about the plan per se, when we talk about the parks and rec centers, how much are we talking about? How many parks? How many rec centers? What do we have here?
Well, that's a really good question. We've got over 6,000 acres of parks. We have over 400 individual parks, and we have 26 community centers. And that's in addition to all the play fields that we have, the ball fields, and our trails like the Berg-Gilman Trail.
And you have any idea how many people use these parks and centers?
You know, if you count the number of multiple users, it's truly in the millions. And people love their parks.
I know that a problem has been, particularly since the economic downturn, how do we fund these things? Currently, where does the money come from to support the parks and rec centers?
Most of it is our general fund. We have a few grants, but primarily it is general fund money. And our taxpayers, as you know, are very generous. And in 2000, they voted for a pro-parks levy. And in 2008, they voted for a parks and green space levy. And that goes to the tune of, you know, 100 plus millions of dollars. And that, on top of the general fund, is the way we've been funding them.
I know during the recession, citywide programs took hits, and that there were significant budget cuts to parks and rec centers, hour cutbacks, program cutbacks, and most definitely maintenance cutbacks. Is the Parks Legacy Project impetus to restore some of the things that were cut, or what exactly is the overall goal?
Well, partly we want to bring the public into the conversation early and talk to them about what do you want to see in your parks. You know, we've got parks programs, we've got things from, you know, people wanting to use their community centers more, to our swimming pools and the things that are really expensive to operate. My goal, frankly, is to say, let's focus on what we have, let's fix what we've got, let's maintain really the things that we have well before we start acquiring more parcels of property. So I think that's the sense that I've got, that people are really behind that. So we're going to be asking the public, and as part of our stakeholders group, what percentage of this, if we do have another levy, which we're considering for August of 2014, how much would you like to see go into operations and maintenance by a percentage dollar? So that's something we're working on, but frankly, my focus is going to be, and I'm going to urge more on the side of, let's take what we've got and let's work on our deferred maintenance backlog.
How much of a deferred maintenance backlog is there?
The numbers are somewhere in excess of $260 million.
Wow.
It's significant.
Yeah, that's, are we talking, I mean, I know, here's my full disclosure, I use a public swimming pool on a regular basis that has a leaky roof right now. It's covered.
Are you in Green Lake?
No, I'm at Meadowbrook, okay. But it, you know, there's a tarp over it right now, and buckets come out when it rains.
Yeah, fortunately, you're in the swimming pool, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
But we have to fix that. You know, we need to fix that, because like anybody's house, you know, if you don't get in and fix it when it first starts dripping, you suddenly have, you know, a $100,000 roof instead of something you could have fixed for much less money.
We're talking with Seattle City Council member Sally Bagshaw, who chairs the council committee that oversees parks and recreation in the city of Seattle. And this month, the city is holding a series of public meetings. And Sally Bagshaw, I know a couple years back when we were at sort of the pit of the recession, the city had a similar set of meetings with maybe a different goal in mind. But I know that there was tracking going on, and that concerned citizenry were showing up to show support for wading pools and swimming pools and rec centers. And one of the questions I have when you're taking public comment is, isn't it the loudest constituents who make their presence felt?
That's a really good observation, Marcy. And so part of what we're trying to do, too, is to reach people that don't normally come out, the ones that aren't the loudest, the ones that just want to quietly say, look, the top program that you have for us is something that we can afford, or our lifelong learning for our seniors. I'll tell you, there is nothing like it anywhere else. And people say, these are the programs we really want to have you maintain. So our goal is to be able to focus on, yeah, what are the priorities? And I have to really hand it to Parks. They've done a tremendous job. And frankly, it was at council's request to look at all the programs and figure out what's sort of the baseline, what are the kinds of things that Parks really should do because nobody else can do it, and then also consider, well, maybe there's some programs that we're offering now that the private sector could offer just as well. So that's part of the analysis.
What are some of the programs that Parks offers that you don't think anybody else could offer?
Let's see, something that nobody else could offer. I mean, obviously, somebody else could offer it somewhere. But, you know, just the kind of things I was talking about with lifelong learning, this is an opportunity for people who wouldn't otherwise get out to meet friends, to have the community programs, to be participating in that. And Parks can do it and provide, you know, leaders to and through our parks. And people just love those. There's a program that we could have called Special POPs, and it stands for Special Populations. And we offer wheelchair basketball, for example. It is so incredibly popular. People come from all around the region to participate in that. And it's something that Parks does and really believes that it provides a service. And then shift over to something like our small craft centers along both Green Lake and in Mount Baker area. Everybody loves those programs. But frankly, those programs are the kinds of things we could look at and say, well, maybe there's a public-private partnership opportunity there.
Are our parks facilities distributed equitably through geographic regions of the city?
Yes. And that's something I'm frankly very proud of. And we have demonstrated that time and time again with our parks levies. that we've focused on something that's called a gap analysis, and Parks put together a real good statistical database-based effort to look at where are the parks, where are there gaps where people don't have parks or green space areas, and in the last two major levies, that's what we did, is to acquire property or to expand play areas that needed to be, to really be geographically fair. And if you go on Parks' website, they have a map that shows of all of the 88 projects that were part of our 2008 levy, which ones are either underway or completed. And it's really a delight to see, if you carve up our city in six geographic areas from north to south, just to see the projects and where they are and how truly, fairly, equitably distributed they are.
So just to reiterate, you said earlier you felt that what we need to do now is not acquire any more property, but to focus on maintaining what we do have?
Yes. Well, I think there will be some acquisition and some development. I'm not saying that because, frankly, that's stuff that's exciting that neighborhoods come out for. But at this point, if it were up to me, I would really focus on let's chip away at our deferred maintenance. Let's have a priority on, you know, just like what you said, let's fix the roof at Meadowbrook and let's fix the roof down in Southeast Rainier, and we're adding a new community center there. Let's make sure that we're really taking care of that deferred maintenance and we've got enough for operations going forward. But there are some great opportunities that people want in their neighborhoods. And so that's part of what we're doing, reaching out to the communities right now, say, all right, let's think about what the priorities are in your neighborhood. But rather than having, you know, hundreds of projects, maybe we'll just focus on a few.
So what is the biggest challenge for Parks Department to continue to do the work that you think is so necessary?
Well, prioritization, if I'm answering the question that you just asked, that we maintain, but we then ask our community, what is it that you would like to see in your neighborhood? Do you want more community center hours? Then we want to make sure that people are using the community centers. That was one of the reasons that we put in people counters, so we actually knew how many people were using it. I think a point you made earlier, Marcy, which was a good one, which is sometimes you just hear from loud voices, and we wanted to see actually how many people were coming in daily to use those facilities. And then we could invest in those facilities, and if areas needed to have a little bit more boost for social equity reasons, that we could invest there too.
So is money, having enough money, the biggest obstacle to doing all this work that you want to do?
Yes. And I will tell you this, that I really believe that Parks has come a long way to making sure that they're running an efficient, effective department. They've had huge cutbacks. You know, in the last 5 years when we were suffering from the recession, still we needed to focus on public safety. That's our first priority, and human services. But Parks provides that glue for our community. It's the place. It provides the place for people to come. It brings people together. People are cleaning up our urban forests. They're doing so much around, you know, our PPATCH work, which actually is run by Department of Neighborhoods. But community comes together around our parks, and we need to fund that. But Parks has done a great job in tightening their belt, and they can go out to the public and proudly say, we've done what you have asked us. We have fulfilled our promises. And now we're going to go forward for the next 6, 7, or 10 years.
I know that the public meetings are taking place through May in various locations around the city. What happens after that? What's the timetable?
Let's see. I actually have a timetable here, but the big picture is we're focusing on a levy in the summer of 2014, so that's a full year away. So the stakeholders group will take the input that we've gotten from the public, and actually that started a year ago. Parks did some great surveys. They did some statistical valid telephone outreach asking people just the questions you're asking me. You know, what do you want to see? What programs are important to you? What would you fund the parks going forward? And it's overwhelming. I mean, the numbers are in, depending upon, you know, who you talk to and what you read, somewhere between the high 70s and the 90s, people saying, yes, we want to fund our parks. So the stakeholder group will help us fine-tune. There are a lot of questions that are on the table about what are we going to fund, how we're going to fund, whether it's going to be another 6-year levy or maybe go up to 10. Kirkland, you know, across the pond, went for a permanent levy for some things. Well, You know, I'm not sure we want to do that, but I think there'll be questions on how long and how much.
Well, it sounds like a lot of work, and we'll be looking forward to seeing what those recommendations are. Thanks for taking time to talk with us this morning.
Marcy, can I throw one more thing in?
Quickly.
This weekend is Mother's Day. Free parking down on the waterfront.
Thank you. Seattle City Council Member Sally Bagshaw. She chairs the council committee that oversees Seattle's Parks and Recreation Department. This is Weekday on KUOW.
There's a new art project coming to Seattle that combines live music and film and sound effects and also has something to do with the Donner Party. We're going to learn more in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
52 degrees in Seattle with clouds and fog. Expecting sun this afternoon with a high today of 73. Tomorrow it's going to be mostly sunny with a high of 79.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to over 130 destinations worldwide. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
921. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Believe it or not, we're going to learn about the life of Robert Ripley in about 15 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Contemporary artists are all about pushing boundaries and blending media, but it's not often these days you hear about the combination of live music and film, more from the silent movie days. So a new piece at Northwest Film Forum caught our eye. We Are All Failing Them is a song cycle set to film and other sounds, and it's a collaboration between filmmaker Britta Johnson, theater artist Curtis Taylor, and our guest, composer Robin Holcomb. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, always.
It's like a wild group. What was the impetus of this project?
Well, I've been thinking about making some kind of a piece regarding the Donner Party for a long time. Not a narrative piece, not telling the story, because it already exists in its magnitude and, you know, all of its horrific aspects. But there are also some, there's severe boredom, severe grandeur. There's so many themes involved in the story. And so it was an idea of mine, and I started to make some sketches, and I started applying for funding, and I started getting a little funding, and then I reached out to some of my favorite people to collaborate with in Seattle.
Maybe we want to take a step back. Bernard and I were talking about the Donner Party, and I think what most of us know is people, they set out, and then they ate each other.
Well, that was one aspect of the story. There were, of course, many people leaving the Midwest, traveling to the promised land of California. And many stories flying about how, you know, you can live for 250 years, you'll never die, you know, there's, you know, acres of verdant fields and so forth. And the group that became that came to be known as the Donner Party left in 1846 from St. Louis, Missouri, and they convened in Fort Bridger, Wyoming, set out on the last difficult part of the passage. But they arrived late for various reasons. The man who was going to guide them had already left, so they had to navigate on their own. And they were enthralled by a book that this guy, Lansford Hastings, had written called The Emigrant's Guide. And he had a cutoff that he'd navigated, and that hadn't been tested too many times. So they tried that. Half of them tried that, and that set them back also. And so it's one thing after another, a cavalcade of misfortunes.
And so you mentioned the extremity of all these things. That's, I mean, you're often inspired by landscape or historical event. Mm-hmm. Maybe other composers are as well, but it's particularly striking in the work that you've done over the years. Mm-hmm. So in terms of making art out of this, is it the fact that you can really push the form of a composition or the actual notes in a composition? What is it that is attractive?
Well, it's like there, in this particular piece, it's like there are huge themes that could easily become operatic or something. I feel like it takes me out of my usual talking about people I know or things I've read about into something huger in a way. And also to an opportunity to articulate things that are universal. And so, like, just listening to the news before I came on just now, just the barbarian, you know, the we are not barbarians mm-hmm. line. I mean, where do you become a barbarian? What's the line you cross to become a barbarian, and where are you trying to survive and so forth? These are fascinating intersections.
We're talking with composer and performer Robin Holcomb. She is part, a third, I think, of a collaboration called We Are All Failing Them that's going to premiere next weekend at Northwest Film Forum, who is a commissioner. This is part of a series of live performances that you don't think of when you think of film anymore.
Well, the Film Forum is wonderful on so many levels. Not only do they present a huge variety of work, they also commission music for film, and few people do that in this town. And not they've had festivals in the past. For example, they showed all the films of Ozu and commissioned new scores for these silent films. Mm-hmm. And I did one of those, and that went on to become it's going to be released on Criterion when the film is re-released. And Laurie Goldston did one, too, and several other people.
But this is different because this is commissioning a film to exactly. new music as well.
It's new work that's being created at the same time. It's not film to music or music to film. It's all happening at the same time. So now we're putting together all the various elements. So this is new for the Film Forum, too, because in their Live at the Film Forum series, which obviously includes live performance and film, they often have engaged a company of some sort or a team of collaborators mm-hmm. that work as a unit, whereas we're not that. So
you're reminding me of sort of the days of John Cage and Merce Cunningham,
exactly,
where Merce Cunningham's making a dance and John Cage is composing some music, and they never come together till the day of the performance. This isn't quite that, is it?
This isn't quite that, but actually that has come up. And we've kind of been in our separate corners making work and meeting regularly for a long time, talking about what the intersections might be. And we're putting all the elements together in the theater starting on Saturday, and the show opens on Thursday. And so we've all seen snippets of each other's work, and we have different things that are going to tie it all together. And I think the idea of making kind of a storm of imagery and hallucination, which had a lot to do with what people went through as they were approaching death by various means.
I've seen a little clip of Bridget Johnson's film, mm-hmm. And it's I guess you could say impressionistic is what mm-hmm. I saw. We're not going to see people eating each other or anything like that.
No, we're not going to see that. I think we're going to be reminded of what we know or don't know about this huge iconic story.
So what's that like for you as, because you're going to be performing as mm-hmm. well as, mm-hmm. as being the composer of this. Have you done much, you did score to an existing silent film, but mm-hmm. have you done much, you know, direct performing to something, or is it just you're going to perform and this visual thing is going to be happening at the same time?
They're all the elements are interacting in a bunch of different ways. Sometimes there's precise moments where things change. Sometimes there's an improvisational approach between elements. Performing will also be Peggy Lee, who's mm-hmm. one of the most amazing improvisers on the earth, who plays cello, and she's also a great interpreter of other people's music. We've worked together for many years. And Danny Barnes, who's going to sing and speak and play banjo and guitar and tuba. And so we've all worked together in various other configurations, but never this particular one.
There's also somebody that I know as a sort of sound artist, Susie
right.
Kozawa. So where
right.
does her work fit into this?
Well, she's been great, and she's going to create live sound effects throughout the piece and addressing a lot of different things, environmental, you know, setting up an environment, but also the dream aspect of things. And she's been bringing her instruments to our meetings, and that's great.
So as a musician, which is what I think of you as, what does it add to your art to have these other art forms worked in with it?
Well, I've always been one. I do totally improvise where anything goes, kind of. It's still always kind of spare, I think, what I do. When I write lyrics, they're always really condensed. And I like to evoke a story or imply something rather than tell something directly. And I like very much the idea of there being several other inputs, to so to speak, with the same kind of aesthetic. And I think the whole thing that's created is evocative in a different way, in kind of an overwhelming way, which I think fits with the story as well.
Will it be different each of the nights?
To some extent, yeah.
Wow.
There'll be a lot of the same elements, but they'll be floated together in different ways. And
Well, we don't have Brita in here or Curtis Taylor, mm-hmm. but I, you know, it strikes me that in dance, in theater, in music, that artists are not wanting to be confined mm-hmm. in, you know, I called you a musician. I could just as well call you a performer mm-hmm. or, you know, a creator. So are we past the era where everybody is labeled with a certain, you know, you're a visual artist, you're a theater artist, you're a musical artist?
I think there's always been a lot of that going on, but I think people are more willing to allow for multiple roles now, acknowledge that that's been always the case, you know. So, I mean, I still write through composed music for various reasons, and Britta and Curtis do projects that are really set. But I think this collaboration is not that different from what people do in general on most projects, but it's more focused. I mean, there's more focus on the vagaries of it, or the it's impossible to predict exactly what it will be, which is there's so many things in the way that we've put this project together that are reminiscent of aspects of the Donner Party, like getting really stuck, or how do you talk about this, or and what will it be, will we make it, will we solve this, and the ways that those things have played out have been very interesting.
Have you answered the questions that you had going in about the Donner Party?
Yes and no, I suppose. It was really interesting doing all the research for it. Everybody did different kinds of research, and it's not like everything falls into place in a neat storyline, and there are so many different accounts of what happened. I feel like it's sort of settled on something, and it's a little hard to articulate that. But yeah.
You have to just see it, I guess.
I think so.
It's called the project. The final performance is called "We Are All Failing Them." It's a new piece for the Northwest Film Forum, a song cycle set to film and other sounds, and it's going to premiere and have its full set of performances May 16th through 18th here in Seattle. Robin Holcomb, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is KUOW.
Remember Ripley's Believe It or Not? Those collections of unusual and hard-to-believe events and animals and stuff? Robert Ripley was the man behind that phenomenon, and according to his biographer, he had a strange and brilliant life. We'll learn more in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington Energy Services, featuring energy-efficient products since 1957 to fit individual home, lifestyle, and budget. Windows, heating and cooling systems, water heaters, and more. Products, installation, and service information online at washingtonenergy.com.
52 degrees in Seattle with clouds and fog. Now the forecast says, a lot like the last couple of days, it's going to turn sunny this afternoon, and we expect to reach 73 degrees. Then it'll be clear overnight, a low of 53. Tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny with a high of 79.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth between ages 13 and 21 to participate in a study of a smartphone app in a self-directed weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
Explain aloud just what you're doing.
Radioactive is a journalism training program for youth ages 16 to 18.
We have some pretty great stories for you.
Summer applications are now open.
So tune in
if you dare.
Apply online by May 13th at kuow.org/radioactive.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
9:33. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Cleveland kidnapping suspect Ariel Castro appeared in court today. We'll have a report on that in the news at 10.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. A 1936 newspaper poll declared that Robert, believe it or not, Ripley was the most popular man in America. How did that happen? How did a young, awkward newspaper cartoonist become a worldwide adventurer, synonymous with the strange and unusual? Well, local author Neil Thompson has written the first official biography of Ripley. He's the author of four books, including this latest, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to be here, Katie.
I want to start with a tricky question. How would you define Ripley? Was he a cartoonist, a journalist, an adventurer?
Yes, he was all those things and more. He's hard to describe, but if I had to put it into just a few words, I would say he was someone who was passionately curious about the world. And he explored that in many ways by exploring the world, traveling obsessively and relentlessly to all corners of the world. He was curious about people and the things that they were willing to do to, feel exceptional. He just lived this pretty over-the-top life and a much overlooked life. I think that was one of the things that was very fun about the book was to rediscover this guy that we sort of know, the idea of Believe It or Not, but to really for the first time explore this guy's full life was great.
That's interesting. So how does a person who's the most popular man in America in 1936 go to be overlooked in our society today?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, he died in 1949. I wouldn't say at the peak of his popularity and fame, but pretty close. It's hard to imagine what would have happened to him after that. His big success came really during the 1930s, during the Depression, when people wanted to be, I think they were hungry for the type of education and entertainment he provided. He gave people just fun tidbits about the world, the strangeness of the world at a time when people needed that distraction. And he was good at it. He was good at it in newspapers as a cartoonist. He was good at it on radio. Then in 1949, he launched his first TV show. And it sort of remains to be seen whether he would have fully adapted to that new medium, because he died in the 13th episode of his first season. He had a heart attack on the air and died a few days later. So on the one hand, I think it's impressive that his brand, this empire that he created, survived, for more than half a century beyond that. The version of Believe It or Not today is sort of missing that core character, the soul of its creator. It's still sort of there, but the personality of this guy has kind of been mostly forgotten.
Is it becoming more of a Disney-like attraction of the strange and unusual? Is that
in a sense? I mean, I think when I first started visiting, I'd visited probably when I was younger a couple of the museums, but then paid more attention when I was working on this book. And I was fascinated that they're not as downscale as I maybe remembered them. Mm. They're really interesting places, some of them. Even my kids walking through there are kind of awed by the little surprising tidbits that you find walking around the corner in one of these museums. So in a sense, yeah, it's a Disneyfication of the Believe It or Not concept. I think by default, it's missing what Ripley brought to the brand, which is his own personality and his own passionate curiosity.
I'm speaking with Neil Thompson. He's the author of a biography called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. You talk about what's missing is the soul of him. In some ways, wasn't the Ripley, Believe It or Not concept at the time all about him? Wasn't it sort of a cult of personality?
It was, in a sense, yeah. Yeah, because he was the one who was traveling to places in India and China and South America, and then bringing back those stories, his version of those stories, to America in the form of his cartoons or radio shows. So it was largely about him, which is interesting because he was originally such a shy, awkward guy, and he really forced himself to become the face and voice of his own brand eventually, as he became more of a radio star and celebrity. I mean, he really was, during his day, one of the more popular entertainers of his time. But that was a difficult transition for him to become so publicly the face of the brand.
Well, maybe we should back up a little bit and have you describe what he was like as a kid.
Yeah, he was grew up very poor, north of San Francisco, a little town at that time called Santa Rosa. And he had a rough childhood. His parents didn't, he was relatively poor. He was this shy, awkward, geeky kid, had very severe buck teeth, like disfiguring buck teeth. And I think he felt like a misfit as a kid. Didn't have many friends. He was picked on as a kid. So he spent a lot of time alone, doodling, you know, spending his time with his head down on a drawing, which is how he made his living eventually. And I think I love that about his story, because he came from so little. His dad died when he was young. His hometown was leveled in 1906 by the great San Francisco earthquake. So he saw a lot of hardship growing up, but he just willed himself to become this successful cartoonist that he always wanted to be, and then went far beyond that and succeeded in these other areas. So I love that underdog quality of Ripley. And I think also he turned that appreciation for misfits and underdogs into a championing of people who were like him, people who were different.
Hence the searching out people who were, what, misfits around the world? Would that be how he would have thought of them or described them?
I think he probably wouldn't think of them as misfits, but I think he appreciated the differences of people like that. People who, for example, there's a little girl who was in one of his museums at the Chicago World's Fair who was missing her arms and legs. She was on stage, and at that time, you know, you could argue that that's exploitation, but he championed her differences, I argue, in the book. She was this cute kid, very well spoken. She had great penmanship. And it's people like that Ripley, he refused to call them freaks. He celebrated their differences. He called them human curiosities or oddities. But he had, I think, I'd argue, respect for people who were different.
Mm-hmm. He eventually gets a job working at the Globe newspaper. Mm-hmm. Why did they decide to send him overseas in the first place? He's just their cartoonist working there. So
yeah, I think he always had this this desire to travel. He paid his own way at one point to go overseas early on in his career. And then later, as you said, the Globe sends him, in fact, around the world in 1921, which was this extravagant expense on their part and probably a risky enterprise, too. I mean, he's, as you said, he's a sports cartoonist. That was his job, to convey the previous night's ball game or boxing match in a cartoon in the next next day's paper. But I think because through the teens, some of his cartoons began to feature some of the things that he was personally curious about, things that he would read about in other parts of the world, or during World War II, he spent a lot of time drawing the battlefield and describing the battlefield as a sports field and that kind of thing. So I think his editors at the Globe were willing to let him, they were willing to take a chance on letting this guy go explore the world and see what they got from it. They were probably nervous about what he would come back with, but readers responded effusively to these drawings from places around the world that they had never seen and were curious about.
Boy, I'd really like to know how he pitched that idea to them. I'm speaking with Neil Thompson. He's the author of four books, including his latest, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. What sort of a traveler would you say he was?
He, at times, was kind of the yokel, occasionally ugly American traveler. Mm-hmm. He refused to... Well, first of all, I mean, I think he was pretty adventurous. He did go to some pretty remote places, some dangerous places. He put himself in harm's way. But he did it in this way that was sort of, gee whiz, look at me. I'm stuck on some mountain in the Caucasus Mountains in Georgia in thigh-high snow, and my car is broken down and I can't get over the mountain pass. Isn't this fun? There's actually a video or film of him trying to dig out his car as he's trying to travel across the mountains into Russia. So he was that kind of traveler. He just went for it and took risks and never entirely let the hardships of travel get him down. The ugly American bit is he would refuse to learn other languages. He just insisted on speaking English. And he would even say, if the other guy can't understand me, I'll just speak louder. So he was that kind of guy. He was a goofy traveler. His uniform became a pith helmet and khaki shorts and this ratty white shirt, and then two-tone spat shoes. He was a pretty strange-looking guy in some of these places.
Well, and sometimes when you look back on his cartoons, at least when I've looked back at them, it reads as very crass sometimes how he characterizes a culture.
Yeah. And, you know, that was a little bit of a reflection of the time. You know, our sensibilities were a little less PC at that time. And so some of that comes through in his cartoons. But I also think compared to other depictions of different cultures and different peoples at that time, he was a little more respectful than most. And I think because he did have that sort of compassion for the way other people live their lives, even if at times it came across as a little insensitive. Mm-hmm.
Did you find anything in your research that was a big influence on him, what his tone was, how he developed his style?
I think there were a bunch of influences, and it's interesting to see them eventually kind of converge. Early in his career, he was covering a boxing match in Reno, Nevada, 1910, and ran into Jack London. And they spent time together, and Jack London critiqued his work a little bit and told him stories about his global travels. There was another guy he met at one point, Burton Holmes, who was a world traveler, teens, 20s, who created these travelogues. He would present travelogue presentations. He also influenced Ripley, in particular, sort of stoked Ripley's curiosity about Asia and especially China. And then there were the cartoon influences. He got to know guys like Rube Goldberg, who was a cartoonist in San Francisco before Ripley, Tad Dorgan, these guys whose names are kind of lost to us now, but were very important and very popular and famous at that time, 19-teens and in some cases into the 20s. And they were all very influential on Ripley's work. So over time, the cartooning, the appreciation for cartoon art and newspaper art, as well as the influence of people like Jack London and these world travelers, it all kind of comes together in how Ripley evolves into this world traveling eccentric cartoonist guy.
Well, and as he becomes more associated with unusual people or unusual things in the world, did he have to find a contrast between him and, say, Barnum and Bailey or these other circus showman types?
Yeah, I think there was some overlap at times, but he, I have a quote in the book from him with regard to Barnum, P.T. Barnum, who believed that people liked to be tricked and to be faked, and Ripley vehemently disagreed with that. He felt like people liked to be challenged with some strange but true fact, but Ripley loved to prove that it was actually true. Whether it was, you know, some strange culture somewhere or just some odd achievement that somebody did as a hobby, you know, writing 1,000 words on a grain of rice. So I think the distinction is that Ripley had a little bit more compassion than the P.T. Barnums and others who you know, did the freak shows of that time. So he showed compassion and respect, but he was proud that everything he showed people was true, that he had actually seen it with his own eyes and verified it.
Hence his trademark line, right? I dare you to prove me wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. He was aggressive about that. And he had a lot of helpers around him trying to prove that the facts that he portrayed in his cartoons or on the air were true and verifiable.
There is something very abstract. I'm not sure how to get at, but there is something that's unsettling about him to a modern audience.
Yeah, I don't think he could be the same kind of celebrity today that he was at that time, because some of the things he celebrated would make people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
like
your,
what an
your sense
exa- what an example? What example would you give?
The example of the armless, legless girl might be one, but I'd argue too the opposite, that some of the things that he portrayed during his day are exactly the kind of things that people like to see today.
Mm-hmm.
One of his famous radio shows was this Indian mystic named Kuda Bux who walked across flaming coals at Radio City Music Hall on the air. So I think there are other examples of Ripley championing strange feats like that, people who would do torturous things to themselves or take huge risks. One radio show, he tried to record a skydiver in mid-flight. They taped a mic to his harness, and his main chute failed to open, and the backup chute caught him, but he still slammed into the ground and had the wind knocked out of him. So I think some of those kinds of features, the things that he featured during his day, you see that today. Survivor, the Amazing Race, going back a few years, Fear Factor and Jackass. I think some of the reality TV phenomena of recent years, you can go back and find examples of that in Ripley.
So it's maybe just that we are conditioned to be more PC, perhaps, than they would have been then.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think part of it, too, is that Ripley, we think of him as primarily a guy who championed and portrayed freaks and oddities, but it was a lot more than that, and that was one of the pleasures of researching the book, is discovering that his curiosity was really broad and wide, and that the freak aspect of it was just a slice of what he did, and a slice of his popularity.
Speaking with Neil Thompson, he's the author of four books, including his latest, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. As he develops more worldly knowledge, after he's been all over the world, to some places countless times, really, do you see him evolving in his attitude? Say, you mentioned in the book that he sees that kids are starving in certain parts of the world and then has to acknowledge that Americans are perfectly well fed at the same time. Do you see his that kind of knowledge altering his actions?
I think I see it altering his happiness. There's this creeping sadness through his life as he travels more and sees the differences between other lands and ours, especially as we reach the cusp of World War II, and he sees some of the places that he loved becoming battlegrounds and becoming destroyed. I think that really affected him. And I think he felt helpless about some of that. He felt helpless about the starvation he saw in places like Russia in the mid to late 1930s. He would talk about it sometimes to the point where NBC would tell him to shut up, because it was a difficult time politically to be, you know, criticizing what was about to be the USSR. And so that helplessness about what he saw elsewhere, I think it did affect him, and it affected the tone of his work a little bit. There's this little bit of melancholy that starts creeping into it, in particular as it relates to China, which was his favorite country. And then after World War II, as he watches it slip toward communism, I think that had a direct effect on his health and even his sanity.
And he did go to Asia after World War II. That was his last trip,
that
right?
Was his last big trip. That's right. In 1948, he was desperate to make one last trip because he felt like if he didn't do it then, he might never be able to get in because of the takeover of communism. And I think that trip was a turning point in his life and was the beginning of the end, actually. He was dead within 6 months. I think he came back from that trip where he saw the devastation of cities that he once loved, Shanghai, just in tatters, and I think it really broke his heart, and he had he became more erratic after that. He drank more after that, and as I said, within 6 months he had passed away.
And you talk a lot about the book about his drinking. Do you think after researching him that he was an alcoholic?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, and I think he probably acknowledged it, but it's just how he lived. And I think others live that way, too, and especially in the world in which he lived. You know, the newspaper world, radio, media guys, he was a celebrity surrounded by other celebrities, and he loved it. He loved to live big and throw parties and stay out late and hang out with, you know, fun, exciting people. But, yeah, I think at times it was to excess.
Yeah, you describe him in the opening of the book as a man who was fascinated with sin. How so?
I think he appreciated sin. I think he didn't judge other countries where, for example, a man could have multiple wives. He had strong views on marriage in general. He was married briefly early on to a Ziegfeld Follies dancer, and it ended badly after a couple of years. And then after that, he had many women, many girlfriends, sometimes multiple girlfriends at one time. And I think that was part of his appreciation for a big, border-free life. He didn't like restrictions. He liked to have multiple girlfriends. He liked to drink a lot. And I think he appreciated that access in other cultures as well.
And he also cited China as his favorite country. Why do you think that was the place for him?
You know, it's interesting, that fascination that he had with China. I argue in the book that some of it began when he was a child. He, as we discussed, he was very much alone when he was a boy and roaming around his hometown. But there was a little Chinatown section in Santa Rosa that he spent a lot of time in. And I think he felt that the shop owners and the laundrymen that he would run into there, who would give him little treats and welcome him into their stores, he liked the compassion that they showed him. A few years later, when he lost one of his first newspaper jobs in San Francisco, he spent a lot of time in San Francisco's Chinatown because he was nearly broke, needed to eat cheaply, and he felt, he even says so at one point, when I was broke and hungry, they fed me. And so he always had this affinity for China and the Chinese. I think he just loved the country. And it became reflected, too, in his work. It was a theme throughout his cartoons. It was a theme in one of his in his three houses decorated with Chinese artifacts and artwork. It was the theme of his early TV show. I think he just had a real appreciation for that land. And even at one point said, I wish I could be reincarnated as a Chinese person.
You think that there's a modern day equivalent to him today?
I don't. I think it'd be hard for him to become a celebrity these days. I do think that there are examples, people who exemplify bits of who he was. I think it would more likely take a mashup of a few different people to create a modern day Ripley. You know, I think Anthony Bourdain has Ripley-like sensibilities, traveling the world. He has this passionate curiosity, as well as compassion for other cultures and other places. I think Oprah, Ripley, you know, a lot of his shows featured reuniting separated twins who were separated at birth, or bringing together, a married couple who was separated during the Holocaust. So I think, a mashup of Anthony Bourdain and Oprah and maybe Maury Povich and Andrew Zimmern, it would take a few people to be cobbled together to make Ripley.
So in your opinion, after researching this book for 5 years, you would argue perhaps that the legacy that we see of Ripley is diminished.
I think it's around us, but it's disparate. You know, I think you see little bits of Ripley in a lot of our current pop culture. I do think you see it in daytime talk shows. I think you see it in the travel shows of Anthony Bourdain and others. I think you see it in The Amazing Race. I think you see it all throughout YouTube. People doing just strange stuff, contortionists or, you know, borderline self-mutilation, and or people just trying to break a record or do something extreme or exciting or different. I mean, I think people want to be recognized for something unique. And I think that's all around us today. And I think Ripley was one of the early and more influential champions of that kind of attempt.
Entertainment.
Yeah.
Neil Thompson is the author of 4 books, including his latest, Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. He has an event, book signing, this Saturday at Elliott Bay Books at 7 p.m. Thanks so much for coming in.
I enjoyed it, Katie. Thank you.
This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. Nice little streetscape. Our listener, Suzette, went to San Francisco a few weeks ago for spring break. She and her family recorded a few sounds, and this was one of them. It's from a little walk through Chinatown. You can hear the sounds from the trolley, traffic, and a violinist. Very nice.
almost like being in San Francisco, but not quite. What interesting sounds are you listening to in the world around you? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of sound and send it to us along with the story behind your recording. Email your sound file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. I like that little fiddle there, Bernard.
I think it's Oh Susanna.
Ding, ding, with the trolley bell.
With a little extra.
Yeah. Very nice.
Lanyap.
Yep.
It's 9:59. The law that privatized liquor sales in Washington state lets larger stores sell booze. Now the state liquor control board is thinking about letting some smaller stores get in on the act. More about that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle University's Albers School of Business and Economics, offering graduate business degrees for working professionals. Next information sessions are on May 15th in Bellevue and May 16th in Seattle. More at seattleu.edu/albers/graduate.
The number of people with dementia and the cost of caring for people with dementia will more than double in 30 years.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.